Good morning. I'm sorry to say we've had a few technical difficulties here. But yes, I will be talking about language change. And the first part of the lecture will be about language change in general. And the second part will be more specifically about constructionalization and language change. So a particular view of how to deal with language change. So the first part of the lecture, I'm going to talk about the fact that language is always in flux, ask the question, why is that the case? What changes? Discuss a little bit arguments about innovation versus change, gradual versus instantaneous change, and just mention some mechanisms of change that are going to be important for later lectures. Neo-analysis, otherwise known as reanalysis, analogy, borrowing, and pragmatic inferencing. After the break, I will talk about constructionalization and constructural changes as defined in the book I wrote with Graham Trousdale and came out in 2013. I will address some critiques of the definitions that we provided. I think they were good critiques and made us think about constructionalization and constructional changes in slightly different ways. I will present the revised characterization of constructionalization, talk about pre and post constructionalization changes, and provide a revised characterization of constructional changes. Next, please. The term language change is a shorthand. It's a shorthand for a complex process of individuals learning and transmitting conventionalized features of a linguistic system. John Bowlby said, change is built into the way language is used. Please recall from yesterday that I'm adopting a usage-based view of grammar and of cognitive knowledge. She also said the mental processes that are at play when speakers and listeners communicate are the main causes of change. Synchronic cognitive linguistics seeks to account for cognitive capacities and assumes at least a tenuous commitment to psychological reality. We are not psychologists, but nevertheless, cognitive linguistics does assume that there's something psychologically plausible and real about knowledge of language. Historical linguists cannot, of course, access minds of people several hundred, even thousands of years ago. We have to work on the assumption that cognitive capacities of the present are the same as those of the past. This is what is called the uniformitarian principle hypothesis. It was put forward by Bill LeBeau in 1972, who argued that contemporary linguistic processes are, to quote, the same as those that have operated to produce the historical record. That's a fairly plausible and fairly well supported hypothesis. But people keep being concerned about it, because they wonder, and that includes me, many of us wonder whether the cognitive processes of individuals born into our current era of multimodal technology are really the same as those of people who lived a thousand or several thousand years ago. It's a very interesting question. And to date, as far as I know, it has to remain fascinating but unanswerable. So I will be assuming the uniformitarian principle. And I think it's perfectly justified to assume it for most of the data that I have, which goes back maybe 1,000 years, but that's the maximum. Most of it's about 500 years or less. Next, please. Hilpert asks us to think about the cognitive commitment of cognitive linguistics and to ask ourselves whether in analyzing change, we're trying to reconstruct individual minds or to offer a framework for descriptions of language change in which discussion of form and meaning context have a natural central place. In my opinion, historical linguists have to do the latter. We cannot reconstruct individual minds. We have to identify plausible paths of change, given the uniformitarian hypothesis. Next, please. Why does language change? Well, it changes because each language user learns a language. You have to learn it afresh. It's not passed on in any way of it's continuous from one person or generation to another. Individuals and groups seek to distinguish themselves by their use of language. Language users from different social, cultural, and national spaces come into contact. And no two language users have exactly the same experience of language. Production and perception are not identical. What I or you say or write may be understood exactly as it was meant, or it may not be understood exactly as it was meant. Those are the main reasons for language change. Next, please. Bybee lists three usage factors that lead to change. Formation of patterns, such as good friends rather than nice friends. Development of routines, result of repetition. How are you? In English, that doesn't require an answer. Certainly not a detailed one. In some other cultures, you need to have a quite elaborate greeting. When I was in East Africa in the 60s and struggling with Swahili greetings, the number of turns was quite complicated for me to deal with because there were at least three or four turns for every new greeting. That's not the case in English. So there are routines of different sorts in different languages. And language is used in context. Bybee said, if what's up occurs frequently as the first utterance when people meet one another, it becomes a greeting and no longer requires a literal answer. Notice that all three of her criteria for change entail increase in frequency or replication, we could say. Moving on to what changes, the answer depends on one's theoretical perspective. Those who take the position that all language users are born with some kind of innate linguistic capacity, the UG of many generative linguists argue that grammars change, not usage change, grammars change. This was proposed by Kuparsky in 1968. That means that which parameters or feature of an inbuilt linguistic capacity are selected may differ from one individual to another. It also suggests that young children are major drivers of change. There are many problems with the UG theory, but one is that young children tend to be very conservative and resist innovative language use. So although it's an attractive idea that language changes because of small children, in fact, it's very unlikely that that is the case. Those who adopt a usage-based perspective, such as Croft, Bybee, myself, argue that usage changes. That means that routines, patterns, and conventions of languages change. And on this interpretation, that usage changes, it's teenagers and young adults who are the major drivers of change. Innovations occur all the time. They occur in the individual. They are instantaneous. So what is the relationship of an individual innovation to change? In most of generative grammar, it is assumed that innovation is the equivalent of change. Now, as I mentioned yesterday, that is somewhat problematic. Some innovations simply do not become conventionalized. The approach that Graham Trousdale and I have used, and Croft and Reinreich Herzog and Lavoie, Hans-Jürg Schmidt, and many others, is the change occurs when some innovations are adopted by a group of language users. Change involves replication and propagation of innovations. It involves centrally conventionalization. So by conventionalization, we mean adoption by a group of language users. Moving on to gradual versus instantaneous change, morphosyntactic change is typically gradual. Change is never A to B, but always A to A or B, and perhaps, not always, to B alone. There's always variation, at least for a while. A may not cease to be used. Using an example that is that crops up in the grammaticalization and the constructionalization literature over and over again, because it is a very good example, is be going to be. This is a motion expression originally. It was used alongside be going to be future in the 18th and 19th centuries. There was variation, that's the A-B stage. Sometimes there's a residue of old and new, so it looks like they are still in variation. But since the 19th century, we have been using the form gonna for the future. And I really am not certain that we still have layered usage, that we still have polysemy. I doubt very much that most native speakers of English think of the motion be going to be and the future be going to be are the same thing. They happen to look alike when you write them, but they don't sound alike. Their prosody is different. And their future one is more reduced. Next, please. So, as I said, replication routinization of the future led to chronological reduction. We find around 1912, we begin to find Ghana represented in writing. So the beginning of the 20th century, we are certain Ghana started to be one of the pronunciations of going to future. As I said, it's unlikely that speakers nowadays link the older and the newer uses. So be going to exemplifies A, that's motion, which was later used as both motion and future. Not any kind of future, but relative future. It was Polysemous at the time. This is around 1630. It was layered for a while as a polysemy. And in the 20th century, there was a split so that you have A, which is the motion construction, and B, which is the future, and they are now homonyms. Now, it used to be when I was a graduate student that changes were thought to be quite large. David Lightfoot in 1979 talked about saltations, so big jumps, catastrophes, that's what he was interested in. But nowadays, even generative linguists, but certainly functional linguists of the type that I'm talking about, regard the steps of micro syntactic change as very tiny micro adjustments. František de Smet has talked about sneaky shifts. I think that's a cute way of talking about what we actually see in the data, the minuscule slight changes over time. Occur across the corpus and across individuals. Now, part of the way, of the reason for this shift in thinking is that we now have electronic corpora, which were not available in 1979. There's a lot of quantitative corpus analysis. Whatever view you have of grammar. And furthermore, there has come to be a very strong focus on shifting context for change. So combining the availability of electronic corpora, quantitative corpus analysis, and attention to shifting context for change leads almost every historical linguist, whatever their fundamental model, to think about micro adjustments, micro sneaky shifts. I will have a footnote here. It's not relevant to discourse structuring markers. This is a footnote to saying that there are some constructions that arise without prior sneaky shifts. Most of these are lexical based on word formation patterns. We talk about them, we, Graham Trousdale and I, in our book. These are things like you have a noun, to which you add a, out of that you make an adjective plus a, meaning having the property of noun. A very old one is happy, which used to be hap, as in happenstance, which is chance, sex e, fault e, and I made up movie a few weeks ago, and I can do it because any noun in English can potentially be turned into an adjective if Y is added to it. We also have a pattern like the adjective plus Y, you add nest to that, and that gives you a noun plus innis and the abstract property of being the adjective. So you get happiness, sexiness, faultiness. I suppose you could get moviness if you had reason to want to talk about the property of being booby. So the pattern building is gradual. It took a long time to get the word formation examples that I have given you, the word formation patterns. Adjective Y is the form, meaning having a property of N. It took a long while to get noun plus inus, having the meaning abstract property of being adjective. But once the pattern is built, new items can be created and understood immediately. As I said, that's really a footnote, just to acknowledge that there are some changes that are instantaneous. Next, please. Changing focus again to mechanisms of change. Neo-analysis, usually referred to as reanalysis, is often invoked in work on language change. But because a child or a second language learner cannot reanalyze a structure that they don't have, reanalysis is a problematic term. And I prefer, a lot of people prefer, a term suggested by the term neo-analysis, which was suggested by Henning Andersen in 2001. It's more neutral. What work on neo-analysis asks is, how is expression X different from expression Y? The question was originally asked by Langacker in 1977 of four. He asked about bracketing changes, category assignment changes, and so forth. And here are a couple of typical examples. Be going to verb. Now you have motion. I'm going for purposes. It's re-bracketed as be going to, be. Think of will verb or shall verb. To be, beside it. Be at the side becomes beside. And a typical recategorization example is turning any noun in English into a verb, like calendar, I will calendar something. It's a very productive pattern. Almost any noun can be used as a verb, and it's a pattern that has continued from Old English times on. People complain about new formations that they hear, but that's just part of English and part of our knowledge of English that we can do that. Next, please. Now, Regina Eckhart, in a book in 2012, argued that meaning change is also neo-analysis. She calls it reanalysis. Talking about the meaning change of be going to be, there's not only the form, which I've just talked about, the re-bracketing, but the meaning is also changed. So motion with a purpose has been reanalyzed, neo-analyzed as future. And that brings together form change and meaning change, both of them undergoing neo-analysis. But there's another major mechanism, and that's called analogy. This asks how similar are expressions X and Y. Remember, neo-analysis asks how different are expressions X and Y. Analogy asks how similar are expressions X and Y. And then we have to ask, on what grounds are they similar? Is it form? Is it meaning? Both. what. Now, the example in four is really basic, but it raises some interesting issues. Example four shows the matching of various plural markers in earlier English to the S plural. That was one of several noun classes in Old English which allowed for all kinds of different plurals. So you had stan, stanas, this is stone, stones. And that S of stanas came to be a model for many noun plurals. It was the model for bok, which was book, which had a plural, bej, which is just like foot and feet. It was analogized to the stone class, and so you get books. Dochter, daughter in Old English, was dochter in the plural, just like sheep and sheep. One sheep, three sheep. No plural mark in modern English. Daughter was analogized to the class of stones. So in four, we have match to form and to meaning, which is the plural. This is what Bybee calls exemplar analogy. And she says, the prime claim of exemplar representation is that each experience with language has an impact on cognitive representation. So she's assuming for current speakers that we have a representation in our head, or language acquires, we gain a representation in our brains. And each time one hears the same kind of form and meaning pairing, that has an impact, and extant representations are supported and enriched. Next, please. Analogy was thought to be too general a notion to be worthy of much attention outside of morphology through most of the 20th century. And indeed, it is very general. Until in 2003 said humans are simply analogical animals. And Olga Fischer argued, picking up on that statement, that analogy is a deep-seated cognitive principle. This is relevant not only to language processing and language change, but also to learning processes outside of language. It's a very, very general process. And she argued that it should receive a lot more attention than neo-analysis. And I think it has since she started talking about it actually in a book that came out in 2007. Graham Housdell, and I think it's important to distinguish two kinds of analogy. There's analogical thinking, which is covert. You don't see it. There's no evidence for it. Language users do it all the time, as Angela says. But there's also analogization, the overt modification of an expression that is the result of such thinking. And in my view, each analogical change involving a specific microconstruction is in fact an instance of neo-analysis. Think about, next page please. Think about bok again. Bok, we had a vowel alternating plural, so it was bej. It was generalized to the, analogized to the general plural. that involves a new analysis. It's analogy, which is a new analysis regarding which plural marker is appropriate for this item. So the analogy was also, the analogization was also a new analysis. Now, it doesn't always happen. Put feet was neither analogized nor neo-analyzed, despite the analogical thinking that leads virtually all children to innovate foots and later feet, and presumably enable the change from plural beds to books. And Bybee has thought a lot about why analogization does not happen, and proposes that that is because highly frequent items are strongly represented in memory. If that's so, I'm puzzled by goose geese. I certainly don't have experience with geese, except perhaps in children's books. It's a puzzle. Next, please. Contact with speakers from other groups inevitably leads to change. But any influence of language contact on language change beyond borrowing lexical items requires extensive bilingualism. I would add that we should not underestimate the role of writing and reading. There's recently been a lot of interest in the influence of translations and cultural traditions, not only on literate writers and readers, but on non-literate language users who listen to sermons, they listen to the Bible, they may listen to the texts of many other religions. Borreguero Zuluaga in 2018 gave us a conceptual perspective on the importance of discourse traditions in the development of temporal adverbs into connectives in Italian and Spanish. And I am going to mention some of the discourse traditions that seem to have given rise to expressions like, by the way. That will be next week, but this is a very important fact that has only recently received a lot of attention. Now, another mechanism is pragmatic inferencing. Neo-analysis, analogy, and borrowing, which I've just mentioned, impact most aspects of language, but pragmatic inferencing only impacts meaning. And in a book that I wrote with Richard Dasher, whose picture is there on the right-hand bottom, we proposed that historically there's a path from coded meanings to utterance token meanings to utterance type, pragmatically polysemous meanings, to new semantically polysemous coded meanings. Notice that that's a definition that talks about fairly small steps from coded semantic meanings, from the original word that be going to, or let's put it in terms of construction, coded meaning of be going to be, this is motion for a purpose, to utterance token meanings where there's an inference to be drawn that if you have a purpose and you're going somewhere with a purpose that's going to happen in the future, to pragmatically polysemous meanings. So you have both motion, be going to, and you have relative future, be going to a new semantically polysemous coded meaning, which is the new meaning of be going to future. We call this the invited inferencing theory of semantic change, or IITSC. You may have noticed there's nothing about context in the statement. Coded implies change is semantic at the beginning and at the end. So I think it's better stated as linguistic data provides evidence that over time, language users may come to associate particular meanings with an expression E, and later generations may interpret these as conventionalized meanings. Here by meaning, I mean what Croft, 2001, means. You may recall in the model that I presented yesterday, meaning is threefold. It's semantics, pragmatics, and discourse functions. So by hypothesis, the mechanism that enables such changes is that speakers and writers implicate pragmatic meanings and invite addressees and readers to interpret them in specific discourse context. And addressees and readers may infer those inferences in the same way or in a different way. Here's an example, still talking about be going to. In TNT, the book that I wrote with Graham Chansdale, we discussed be going to be, and we cite this example. It's from 1477, there's another one from 1475. So they're just two examples at the end of the 15th century, where at least a modern reader can infer that there was some emphasis on future meaning. And it all depends on the context. There passed a thief before Alexander that was going to be hanged, which said. Now the thief was being walked to his execution. So this is motion with a purpose. It was not his purpose because this is passive. It was somebody else's purpose. It was the hangman's purpose, but it is motion. And the relevant inferences are that the execution was in the future and the thief was minimally agentive in the event. He was not walking anywhere willingly, presumably. The analysis as a relative future in the early 17th century, the case of subjectification as the speaker establishes the temporal relationship. And here's an example. There are quite a few examples somewhere around 1610 on, which have nothing overtly to do with place or agency, but rather suggest future. So for want of a cord, he took his own garters off, and as he was going to make a noose, I watched my time and ran away. So there was somebody who took his garters off, which are ribbons around your leggings, so to keep your leggings up. And he was going to make a noose out of them. I watched my time and ran away. Well, it's possible he was going somewhere to make a noose, but there's nothing said there in the text about his going anywhere. And that's the kind of example that's useful, because there were great increase in the number of examples like that, where there is no reference whatsoever to space or direction, and only to an activity that's going to occur in the future. And in the 18th century, there was further subjectification and neo-analysis as a deictic future. In the 17th century, what we get is a relative future, which has to do with sequence of events. And in the early 18th century, we get examples of the kind that, as I will say later, Langacker regarded as a case of subjectification in his sense of subjectification. This is an early example, 1725. I'm afraid there's going to be such a calm among us that. Now, that is a deictic future. Future of me, there is going to be, future of my time of utterance, there's going to be such a calm among us that. These are raising examples. Absolutely none of them that anybody has found before about 1700 would be going to. So this is a new syntactic possibility and evidence that a change had occurred. Now, I've mentioned subjectification, and because there was a question about it yesterday, I wrote up some slides about my current view of it. Here, these slides depart from whatever slides you may have received already. I've added three on subjectification. It is characterized in Traugott and Dasher as meanings tend to become increasingly based in the speaker's subjective belief state or attitude toward the proposition. I think that's true. We thought of it as a mechanism. But further thought since 2002 has raised the question, is it really a mechanism? What does it mean to say it's a mechanism? A mechanism is a how of change. How does the change happen? Neo-analysis is a how, and analogy is a how. Neo-analysis is how we're making a differentiation. Analogy is a how of making similarity, matching. Langacker in 1990 talked about it as construal. I have now come to the conclusion that it's something different. Next slide, please. So let's talk about Langacker for a moment. Langacker uses the example, an earthquake is going to destroy that town. That may remind you of the one from 1725 that we looked at a little bit earlier. He says, it is not the subject who traverses the path. It is not the earthquake, obviously, who traverses the path. It is instead the speaker or conceptualizer who traces mentally along the path in order to situate the process in relation to a reference point. It's interesting that he still keeps the path there. And I have no doubt that there is some conceptualization going on here. But conceptualization is not the same, in my view, as change. I'm quite aware about itty and ation, and my students always laughed about it. Itty is a state and ation is a process, in my view. Nor does Langacker's explanation account for the fact that certain types of linguistic function always entail some degree of subjectivity. Tense, aspect, modality, the discourse structuring markers that we talk about, and the illocutionary uses of speech adverbs, the performative uses of verbs like promise that Richard Dasher and I talked about in our 2002 book. Certain kinds of linguistic function, in my current thinking, always entail some degree of subjectivity, some more and some less. Now that I have a framework to rethink the link between subjectification and grammaticalization that I identified in 1995 and elsewhere, I have a new view. I currently think that any new procedural recall is an item that cues relationships, grammatical, discourse structural, and so forth. Any new procedural will minimally inherit low subjectivity and or low intersubjectivity from the schema to which it is recruited. Subjectification and intersubjectification of a particular construction will have occurred at a low level. This is the default of the functional change and the task to which the expression is put. I'm going to discuss this a lot more in connection with discourse structuring markers and especially discourse markers. So you will have a lot more examples of this idea and more opportunity to think about it and perhaps challenge it. But the basic idea is that when be going to verb was first used as an auxiliary and a procedural and a temporal, it was the subjectification. It's not a cause or a how, it's not a why or a how, but a result of recruitment to an auxiliary tense construction. It's a very different way of thinking about it from what I had before. But the phenomenon remains the same. There's no question that a very large number of things are subjectified, and be going to is subjectified when it becomes future. The question is, what is the role of subjectification in that change? And I think its role is a result role. Now, next, please. Sometimes contextual uses lead to intersubjectification, the development of meanings that pay attention to the addressee or reader's face. And I'm going to discuss an example of that in talking about, by the way, which is used as a hedge. It's also used as an impoliteness marker. And it's combined with O. And intersubjectification, as discussed in Traugott and Dasher and elsewhere, is a historical process, not a construal, in my view. We called it a mechanism, but again, I now think it is the result of use in a construction with a specific intersubjective function, such as politeness or impoliteness. Meanings can come to be more subjective or more intersubjective than they were earlier. So in questions in final position, for which answers are expected, come to be routinized as attitudinal tags, for which no answer is expected, an already intersubjective expression becomes subjectified. Totti and Hoffman, 2009, talk about examples like this that appear in the 16th century, like 9. I told you, did I not, that there would be a fray, that'd be a struggle. No answer is expected, nor is it given. This is a play. So you can tell, no answer is expected or given. And I'd like to note that this is not a counterexample to intersubjectification. I read someone who was arguing that it was. It's not a counterexample to intersubjectification because it starts out with intersubjectivity, that is the question tag, which wanted an answer. It has now been used as a discourse marker or pragmatic marker. And it's an example of how a discourse function predicts the type of intersubjectivity that will arise as the result of change. So you can use any kind of expression as an attitudinal tag, and it will be subjectified because attitudes are subjective things. So in summary of this first part, language changes the development of shared conventionalized usage. That is the key takeaway points. Language changes the development of shared conventionalized usage. The major motivations for change are language acquisition, which happens throughout life, group identities and differences between perception and production, and the major mechanism for changes are analogy, neo-analysis, and borrow. So at this point, let's have a break, a 5-minute break, and come back to talking about constructionalization and constructional change.
Yeah, we have a 5 minutes break, and we come back at 7 to 9 o'clock.
Right, I'm a little bit worried that because I'm not changing the slides, it's going a little bit slowly, and five minutes. 5 minutes late. I don't know. Sean, are you there? Sean? No? I'm going to send her a message and say, I really appreciate her doing this, and I'm sorry she's doing it, but we're going to need to go a little bit faster if we're going to have enough time for questions. That's the point. Sean, okay. Are you there?
Yes, oh, I'm here.
Yeah, okay. I think you know pretty much when I get to the end. And I'm sure it's very good for people to have the opportunity to look over the slide. It may be that in future, if this happens again, I'm going to have fewer slides. But I'm just a little bit worried that there won't be enough time for discussion.
Okay.
So, is there some way I can help help you know when to change the slide?
Yes, when I hear the your voice of changing, I shall change, or you may tell me next.
Well, I have been telling you, but I've usually been telling you after when the policy appears to be slightly long.
Okay, I see.
So I think you get it when my voice drops. It tends to drop at the end of the slide, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mind if you go too fast. I can always ask you to go back.
Okay, right? Yes.
I mean, if you miss cue, I don't think it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
The problem might be if we don't have enough time. Because... let me see, how many slides do I have left? And I know some people are going to be interested. Well, I have 22 slides. That should take about... Yesterday they were taking about 1 a minute, so I think we'll be all right. I think we'll be fine. I really appreciate you doing this. It was really terribly distressing. I have to do it. And perhaps we can, you and I can meet a little bit earlier tomorrow and see that I can get my share screen working, because it did yesterday. I just don't understand what's wrong. But anyway.
Don't worry.
Something to do with you. Something to do with this, my system, your system, or something. I don't know. Anyway, should we be starting again?
Okay.
Now let's come to the second lecture. The title is Constructionalization and Constructional Changes. Welcome, Professor Chagat.
No, thank you. I mean, I don't think I need an introduction, but that's fine. Let's proceed. Thank you. Okay, what I'm going to be talking about now is diachronic construction grammar. What I talked about in the first part was essential to working in diachronic construction grammar. But now I want to ask the question, what does a constructional perspective on change focus on? It focuses on the development of conventionalized patterns, analogical thinking, and analogization are important here, which is why I spent some time on them. Assemblies of linguistic contexts and collocations are important here. And so are changes in constructional space. I will talk about that later in the lectures. That has to do with the strength of alternatives. And if you have a number of alternative ways of saying the same thing, some are more marginal, some are more central, and the central marginal relationship can change over time. Now, Graham Trousdale and I proposed a distinction between constructionalization and constructional changes. Aspects of the distinction have been challenged, and I present both the original and the revised characterizations. But before I do that, let me make a few comments on linguistic internal context. Next, please. I seem to be missing something. Context. Ivy et al. In 1994 said, everything that happens to the meaning of a gram, which is a grammatical morpheme, happens because of the context in which it is used. They said that back in 1994 in the context of grammaticalizations. But I think you could say that that is true of all types of change, and certainly it is true, equally true, of constructional change. The contexts that we can glean from corpora are primarily linguistic. They are co-text. They are the texts surrounding an expression. These are the kinds of things that De Smet was thinking about when he was talking about sneaky changes, the tiny little modifications of context that we find when we have electronic corpora and we look for context, we will find tiny changes. So constructionalists and others look for replicated contexts in the syntagmatic linear flow of speech and writing, the collocations, and choice of paradigmatic alternatives in a particular slot. So what can you use in slot A or B? And systemic changes such as word order, vowel shifts, and how these relate to the syntagmatic and paradigmatic changes. Since form and meaning are combined in a construction, we propose to use the term constructionalization, a term that had first been used in Austere 2004 and Noel 2007, we use this term constructionalization to refer to the creation of form new, meaning new combinations of signs. It forms new type notes, which have new syntax or morphology and new coded meanings in the linguistic population of speakers. It is accompanied by changes in degree of schematicity, projectivity, and compositionality. Now, there's a lot in that definition. First of all, type nodes. What are type nodes? Nodes in construction grammar are constructions with networked links to other constructions. They are analogies to what we think of as neural network nodes. But since changes do not always result in a new form meaning pairing, for example, the future be going to becoming be gonna be, we proposed a distinction between constructionalization, the creation of a new construction, and constructional changes, modifications to the constructions. And we called that constructional change is a change affecting one internal dimension of a construction. It does not involve the creation of a new node. So basically, it doesn't involve the creation of a new form meaning pairing. Now, many people, including ourselves, have not been satisfied with the distinction, or perhaps with the way in which it was articulated. Among others, Boyers et al. In 2015, Hilpert 2018, and Flach 2020 have criticized the distinction between constructionalization as the coming into being of a form new, meaning new pairing, and constructional changes as changes that affect one component of a construction. The argument is that changes affecting only one component of a construction are rare. Most form changes have some discourse functional aspect. When I was a graduate student, people were always saying, change in form is change in meaning. The rise of gonna is associated with casual speech. If casual speech is regarded as a discourse function, then the emergence of gonna should count as a new form meaning pairing. The phonology has changed and the discourse function has changed on that interpretation. I don't really have time to go through all the arguments, but Flach is particularly interesting. Flach argues that there are two readings of constructionalization. One reading is, in her view, a process reading suggesting by accompanied by changes in degree of schematicity, projectivity, and compositionality. And second, a point or result reading associated with creation of form new, meaning new signs and notes. And she suggests that constructionalization, as characterized in the quotation, refers simultaneously to constructional changes surrounding the new node and the new node itself. And what she's worried about is that what she calls constructional changes muddies the distinction that we were trying to make between constructionalization and constructional changes, between process and point change. Now, there's certain points of agreement that Graham Trousdale and I have with what Flach said, and certain points of disagreement. The picture of her. Flach proposes that constructionalization is a term that should be reserved for the point reading, and this entails instantaneous change. And constructional changes should be reserved for the process reading, and this may be gradual. A problem for us is that point and instantaneous change, in our view, can be identified only for individual innovations and individual speakers and writers manifested in individual written texts. But change in our thinking is conventionalization and is gradual. And therefore, we have a problem with the suggestion that constructionalization be reserved for the point reading. And we recognize that the distinction between constructionalization and constructual changes is sometimes a bit hard to maintain when we're doing fine-grained quantitative work. And it depends an awful lot on what one puts in as parameters in one's regression analysis. However, corpora attest to the rise of new conventionalized form meaning pairings in our view, and these changes are different in kind from some other types of change. So we think the distinction is worth maintaining. But when I look at corpora, something tends to emerge as a new construction, and it emerges over time, and it's very striking. So we propose to characterize constructionalization in a very simple manner. Constructionalization is the establishment of a new symbolic association of form and meaning, which has been replicated across a network of language users. This is meant to highlight conventionalization and clearly replication. Establishment differs, is meant to differ from Planck's point because the outcome is interpreted as the result, however temporary, of changes involving gradual spread across members of community and not innovations. Question is, what process leads to this result? And I think we grossly underestimated the complexity of constructional changes. They are, I will suggest, quite complicated. And in processes that lead to a constructionalization, both individual and communal issues come into play. Individuals are relevant for innovation, and communal groups are relevant for conventionalization. Constructionalizations are the result of shared generalizations over constructs. I just mention as a footnote that there are other views. Smirnova, for example, in 2015 suggests that constructionalization is a process of gradual accumulation of contextual restrictions prior to structural reorganization or neo-analysis of material such as form meaning change. So what she calls constructionalization is actually pre-constructionalization in our view, but then she doesn't talk about post-constructionalization. So there isn't any comparability really between her view as expressed in 2015 and ours, either in the book or currently. Pre-constructionalization, you're going to find multiple small changes, as I have mentioned. These pre-constructional changes are tendencies, they're not determinative. So they often involve certain replicated things. One is chunking. Chunking, so that's the term that constructionists and others use for the routinization of certain groups of words or morphemes or clauses. Chunking and some loss of compositionality within a construction. That is the diminution of the degree to which the meaning of a construct is accessible. So be going to be, motion with purpose is less compositional in the passive than in the active. You can retrieve the meaning of it less well in the passive. So that example I had from 1477 about a thief who's going to be hanged is less compositional than the soldiers were going to hang a thief, because the agent is not overtly expressed. We'll also find quite often some loss of analyzability within a construction. That is, the parts become less distinct and accessible. This is clear from be going to be to be gonna be. The parts of gonna are not very accessible or accessible at all. Third, there are adjustments that involve replication of semantic content or syntactic context that are only relatively loosely connected with the emerging new construction. They include changes in routinized assemblies of constructions and belong to a codex that is generally quite large, according to Butz and Petre. What a fixing of strings. And there's increased frequency of assemblies of cotextual shifts. All of that pre-constructionalization. Next, please. Let's have an example. An example of assembly is elaborated in Petre 2019 and Butz and Petre 2020 for, again, the development of be going to be. They identify two main contexts in which control by an agent is deprofiled. It's the deprofiling of the agent that leads to or enables a reinterpretation of motion as future, in their view and ours. So Lady Mary of Burgundy, whom he was going to marry when death prevented him. That's an example, and there are many of them, that suddenly appear in the 16th, early 17th century. They weren't simply on there in the data before, but now we get a whole lot of them. This is an example of a relative clause. And in a relative clause, whom, a lady, has been topicalized, and imminent action is emphasized because the topicalization reduces attention to the he, whom he was going to marry, when death prevented him. So this happens also in questions, who was he going to marry, and so forth. That kind of context appears far more frequently at the beginning of the 17th century than it did before. And use in passives. Well, I gave you an example from 1477. So clearly it was used earlier. I said there were two of them around that period. So passives, and also use in questions, and also use in relative clauses, all exist in the corpora. But what you find is a sudden increase in use of be going to in relative clauses and questions where an MP is topicalized. There's increase in use of passives. An example of a passive, you see my magazine, which is ammunition, storage, and gun, is going to be taken from me. Next, please. So, as I said, there were dramatic rises in the frequency of use of these contexts. Topicalization in the 1620s, passive in the 1640s, and this lead but Petrae to hypothesize that there was what they call a qualitative leap associated with the conventionalization of a pattern, or indeed the emergence of a new construction. I suppose by qualitative leap, they mean a distinct internal structural shift, or conceptualization, but a new form meaning pairing arose out of, or was enabled by, increased use in the frequency of these contexts. Jet Boots on the left and Petrae on the right. So now, rather than having just one simple kind of constructional change, pre-constructionalization, I suggested four different kinds of criteria for thinking about pre-constructionalization. I'm sure there are many more. My only purpose here is to show the complexity of different kinds of enabling factors that one can find in corpora when looking at pre-constructionalization, and now I'm shifting to post-constructionalization. Again, there are several kinds of changes that we find. Post-constructionalization in a process of propagation across linguistic contexts known as actualization, which Henning Andersen talks about, and many other people, including De Smet in 2012. The modifications are on the whole more local than those prior to constructionalization, according to Boots and Petrae. And again, these changes, post-constructionalization, are tendencies. Often what we get is collocational expansion, spread to new immediate environments, not to new classes of syntactic types, which we get before constructionization, but expansion to new immediate environments, what is often called host class expansion. Hilpert has talked extensively about this. For example, loosening of restrictions on the verb and on the subject in the case of be going to future. Or in the case of connectors, use the scope over the following clause. We're going to talk about, by the way, used to be an adverbial of direction. She felt as she was walking along the path. Then we find around 1650, she fell, by the way, but by the way, was tagged on the end and indicates that her falling should be taken as, or there's a pretense that her falling should be taken as something not very important. Or by the way, she fell, where by the way, again, signals what comes up is a digression not very important. Other types of post-constructional change. There's increase or decrease in frequency of use. So change in token productivity of the new construction. There's generalization over micro-constructions and alignment to other micro-constructions that may lead to incorporation into a more abstract schematic type note. So think about be going to be again. It was constructionalized as a relative tense, which has to do, as I said, with sequence. But that meant that it wasn't a very good auxiliary of the future because already extant auxiliaries of the future, like will and shall, were both relative tense markers and deictic tense markers. So generalization over various uses of be going to and alignment to other future markers seems to have led by analogy to the incorporation of be going to be into the future construction and use of it as a prototypical future. This results in increase in type productivity. That is, the options that are available for the future have increased. First of all, it was will verb and shall verb. And now in the 18th century, we get be going to verb added to the future construction. And at the same time, we get the deictic future, which is aligned to other futures that are already pre-exist in that schema. And so we get a better fit. The deictic future gives us a better fit into the future schema than the relative future did. As we've seen, there are examples of raising constructions with be going to. There were plenty of raising constructions available for will and shall long before the 18th century. So the fact that be going to verb as a future starts to be used in the 18th century means that presumably by analogy, speakers were beginning to align the future to whatever other futures already existed. And here's Boutsen Petrée's example from 1720, 5 years earlier than ours, which looks as if there was going to be another subscription. Now I'm going to attempt to provide a model of the development that I've just talked about, the changing properties of be going to be using Croft's model of a construction that I introduced yesterday. The construction that has within it three possible form parameters, which is syntax, morphology, phonology, and three meaning parameters or features, which is semantics, pragmatics, and discourse function. In this model, I have entered only the characteristics that change. If there's a blank, it's because nothing has changed. And I have used some shorthand because it's hard to get a lot of this into one model. So CL is clause and rel CL is a relative clause and rel future is a relative future and W means with. I'll explain this as we look at the model. Next, please. Here it is. It's very difficult to get all this information into one slide. So I have here characterized changing features of be going to be up to 1900. This does not include the gonna change. Now, how do we introduce context in a model of this sort? I must admit, this is just me. I have tried to put context in by slotting it in between the changes and marking it with a different color. I hope you have better ideas about how to do that, and I would be very interested to know what they are. But anyway, if you read this from 1450 to the present, we have be going to be, which is motion with the future. It's syntactically an intransitive verb, there's a clause, and to be purposive clause. So two clauses. Morphologically, it is be going and to be. And phonology is something like going to. I'm not putting all the rest in, and just the crucial part is going to. Semantics is motion with a purpose. Pragmatics is future oriented. And the discourse function is agent controlled event. Now, as I said, there were changes in context from between 1450 and 1610 and later 1620, 30, 40. Beginning first half of the 17th century, these are use in relative clauses, passives, and other things. I've only talked about the relative clauses and the passives. So the context that is mentioned here is only a small segment of context, which no doubt were relevant. But as Boots and Petre say, there's a huge change in frequency from the 1600s on, which must have had some effect. And we begin to find examples around 1610 is the earliest, most of them 1630, 1640, which suggests that be going to is now used, not only in that motion sense, but also as an auxiliary. So its syntax has changed, not two clauses anymore. It's now an auxiliary. The morphology has changed because the bracketing has changed, as I discussed. The semantics has changed. It's now a relative future tense. Pragmatics has changed. It's an intentional future. The discourse function has changed. It's a temporal sequence. That, in our view, is a constructionalization. Form and meaning have changed. Then there are further further contextual changes, such as use in writing, collocations with stative verbs, and various other ones, which I have not had time to mention. And somewhere between 1700 and 1900, we get be going to be used as a future, which is deictic pragmatically, and discourse functionally is a prediction. Nothing has changed in the syntax, morphology, or phonology. That is, in our view, a constructional change. And I think putting the changes into some kind of formal representation of this sort really helps one see why it is valuable to make a distinction between constructionalizations and constructional changes. There really are some pretty fundamental differences between the kinds of changes involved that I'm sure will be a matter of debate, and I welcome that debate. So next slide, please. Pre-constructionalizations and post-constructionalizations are constructional changes. And so how do we characterize constructional changes? As of now, we call them modulations of contextual uses prior to and following constructionalization, but we're still working on characterizing constructional changes. As I've shown, they can be quite complex, and that very brief characterization may not be sufficient, but it certainly tells us quite a bit about what happens in the contextual uses prior to and following constructionalization. So in sum, a constructionalization approach focuses on the emergence of new constructions as a result of use in replicated context and on further changes post-constructualization. Be going to verb is being used as a prototype case of both grammaticalization and constructionalization. And tomorrow, my intention is to outline the goals of grammaticalization and compare grammaticalization and constructionalization approaches. As I said in response to a question yesterday, I regard them as complementary. It is not one is better than the other. They ask different questions, they look at different data, and they can enrich each other. So now is time for questions, comments, and challenges. I'm sorry we're ran a little bit late. It was technological problems at the beginning. I hope to see various questions and comments in chat.